part of with the shop. Because you mentioned what discusses the problem of resource allocation. The shop says that we built our community is spread out with houses in a number of different places, and we sense that a flood is coming. So the way we avoid the flood is we build a wall. And the wall diverts the water. But the shop makes an observation that's obvious, which is the higher the wall, the more likely it is to withstand the flood. On the other hand, to build a very high wall in a very long, large area is very hard. So the larger the area you want to cover to protect with your wall, you know what it turns out? The shorter the wall. So we can build a 50-foot tall wall that's 6 feet long, or we can build a 50-foot wall that's 4 feet tall. We have any number of different permutations. We can do the shop says. You build an extremely high wall that covers the whole area. One in a lot. But we don't have the resources to fully and completely protect everybody 100%. So what do we do in that circumstance? How do we decide your house is too far away from the center, so we're not going to build a wall around it? What you need to do is the floodwaters come and abandon your house and come into an area that's protected, and you will suffer a terrible loss. And how do we decide what is the protected area? Who gets protected? And how much protection do you get? And the shop is the only person who discusses the problem. Indeed, if you stop and read the medieval literature on wall building in cities throughout, you see that this was a central issue in the community. How large an area should the wall be, and how tall should the wall be? And by the way, there's another thing that was always discussed. Who should pay for it? Who should pay for the wall? Everybody said, what we want is a very tall wall that encompasses a very broad area, and somebody else should pay for it. That's everybody's dream wall. It's a very tall wall encompassing a very broad area, paid by any set of taxpayers that does not include me. And this conversation, by the way, was ran for hundreds of years in the Jewish community. The shop is an answer. And we have to wrap our hands around an answer, and then we have to limit it in some way. The shop says the normative view. These kinds of decisions are made by government. They're not made by individuals. They're made by government, and government engages in a very complex set of balances that determine how tall they want the wall to be, and in what areas we want the wall to be very tall, in what areas we want to be short, and what areas you go without a wall because you just can't afford to build a wall there. But the shop says something very important. The shop says this is limited to situations where the protection of any one person or any individual is beyond that person's ability to do. But any given individual, you know what he can do? He can build his own wall. And he can protect himself as he sees fit. This distinction between resource allocation that's done by the government and resource allocation that's done by an individual represents an extremely important distinction from a halakhic perspective. When I set out to protect myself from whatever difficulty I am encountering, I need not consider how what I'm doing affects you. I can do what? I can protect myself. And if the consequence of protecting myself, you go without a certain amount of protection, certainly so long as the protection I have is reasonable, I'm allowed to use my resources to protect myself, even if very moment, and I desperately need four, but three is of little use in any way, shape, or form. So I say to you, you know what we should do? We should do something very efficient. You should give me your spare tire so I can drive and you can drive. What's the problem? What law goes through the back of your mind? What happens if you were wet? To which I say to you, well, why should the possibility that maybe you don't have a flat take away from the fact that I definitely have a flat right now? Why should your, in the rabbinic phrase, your stopping, take away from my bada? You might have a flat at some point in the future, and then you might need a spare tire, but I definitely have a flat right now, and I need a spare car. So tell me what the answer is. I come from a law school Socratic tradition of teaching, which is very different than the medical school tradition. We encourage audience participation, and if you say something dumb, the person who's teaching takes a whack at you. So I want to encourage people to participate under those ground rules. So what happened? Come on. You say to me, but I need the spare tire very bad, and I can't have three tires. You have five. What did you say?
Sure.
You say, too bad, sorry, that's right. And what's the rationale for depriving me of an asset that I very badly need?
I might need it.
You might need it. But how do you deal with the fact that I definitely need it?
Which is not mine.
The answer is that it's yours. If this were a governmental tire that the government had to give out to whoever needed it the most, the government might well give me the tire. Take it away from you. So if we were in the army and we were all driving our jeeps, and my tire blew out and you had a spare, the general would definitely tell you, give your spare to me so that we can all drive away. But it's not the government, it's not a communal tire. You say to me, it's my tire because I have a reasonable expectation that I might one day have a flat. I'm not going to give you my tire, even though it's going to cause you incredible difficulty and sorrow. The fact is that you are allowed to have a reasonable level of caution and protection of when disaster comes to you from your own resources. Now, this might not be the case if in your trunk you had 17 spare tires. It might well be that as a matter of philosophy, when you have so much protection in your trunk that you couldn't possibly imagine needing all 17 spare tires, you'd be incumbent as a matter of affection or caring to give me a tire. But most of us don't buy, so to speak, 17 spare tires. Most of us drive around with one. Those of us who are totally and completely neurotic will drive around with two. But more than that, we don't do. And this distinction is very important. When I'm dealing with the scarce allocation of resources that are privately owned, halakha says something very different than when we're talking about the scarce allocation of resources that are publicly owned. And this distinction becomes extremely important. And as the Shoto's famously observes based on Yerushalmi, the public-private distinction is itself not just about individuals, it sometimes applies to different communities. And the Shoto gives a very famous example. Communities in those days, and sometimes even nowadays, suffered from droughts. And the way you avoided the drought was you built a very deep well. Your society took a great deal of its resources, and it paid somebody to dig a well as deep as it could. Other societies that were less prudent, what did they do? They dug a less deep well. So if our little community of 50 families puts all its resources into a well digger, and we have a very deep well, and your community spends all of its resources on a diplomat, come drought time, your community is going to come to my community, you know what it's going to say? We need water. Now, the shelter observes what's the obvious problem. If my community has to give your community water, then what does that do?
We have less water.
That's 100% correct. And not only that, we have a disincentive to do what? Dig a deep well. Well, if the guys who built the discotheque partying all the time, and then when they needed water, they went to the guys who dug a deep well. And the guys lot of the dozen deep wells didn't get the part of the discotheque and they had to share their water with the people who built the discotheque, something's really wrong here. So the Shoto says that we can use our water not just so that we can drink, but we can even use our water to do what? Feed our animals and wash our clothes before we give our water to the young men. Because you know what they were supposed to do? They were supposed to dig a deep well too. So you see from the Shotos that the definition of individual in a community isn't just one person versus many people. Sometimes collections of people form conglomerates and invest in themselves, and they have some sort of status of an individual. So you have to realize that when you talk about allocating health care resources, the first question you have to figure out is, are you talking about a private system, or are you talking about a public system? Currently, in the United States, how does health care work? I understand that, I'm sorry. Lucky you, but there are other alternatives, but here's where you are. But what happens in the United States? You have both. That's right, you have private pay health care, and you have public pay health. Public pay health care, it runs more or less on two tiers. Which one is better?
Public.
You must be paid. Which one provides the general, I run a medical ethics committee at Emory University. We manage both the largest private hospital and the largest public hospital in the state of Georgia. The largest private hospital is called the Emory University Hospital. The largest public hospital is called Grady Memorial. You got it. Now, everybody in Atlanta knows that Grady Memorial is only better than Emory for one thing and one thing only, which is if you've been shot. Because Grady specializes and gets so many gunshot wounds that they really know what they're doing. For every other topic, you're better off going to Emory because, in general rule, the private pay hospitals provide a higher level of funding, a higher level of care. Now, I'm not defending that model at this point. I'm merely describing it. In a private pay system, the notion that we can redistribute the assets to provide better care to everybody as a whole might be undoubtedly true, but it doesn't address the basic philosophical response, which is, since I am paying for my own care, the fact that you can take the care that I bought and give it to somebody else who needs it better, the proper philosophical response is too bad. It's like saying to me, I bought an insurance policy for cancer, and I've got a very, very, very fatal form of cancer. The guy next to me didn't buy an insurance policy for cancer, but he has a much less fatal form of cancer, which if diligently treated, he's very likely to survive, whereas I, even if I'm very diligently treated, am unlikely to survive. And you say, as a matter of luck, I should give him my policy. The answer is, of course not. There's no obligation to do that as a matter of Jewish law. If you think about health care costs as private ownership costs in which the user pays, then the fact that we can redistribute these assets to produce a better result in terms of systemically saving more lives and providing higher quality of life for better care for society as a whole, Halakha says that's nice, and that might be unquestionably true, but that doesn't impose upon any individual who has access to privately paid for health care any sort of an obligation to participate in this process. No person, as a matter of Jewish law, has to diminish his access to life-saving treatment merely because somebody else could derive better use from that self-saving, from that same life-saving equipment or treatment. There is no such obligation as a matter of halakha, at least up until the point where the resources that I have more than adequately covered me. Again, if I have 17 spare tires in my trunk, I'm probably obligated to give some of those spare tires away to people. But most of us, as my mother used to say, can't have too much help. So you're hard-pressed to imagine a situation where you would exactly construct it. To just kind of model. On the other hand, if you conceptualize the distribution of healthcare as a government allocation of healthcare for the benefit of the population as a whole, not paid for by individuals who purchase healthcare policies, but instead paid for by the government, then the government's job, as Schaff has told us, is to allocate scarce resources in a way that does what? Benefit to those people in a nice colloquial way. We'll stop before the very end and talk about how exactly should that allocation be done. But for certain, if you imagine healthcare to be the kind of resource that's distributed not purchase-based by an individual, but allocation-based from the government down, like, for example, a city wall or many other types of protection that only the government can provide, then it's relatively clear that Malacca imagines that it's the job of the government to take that scarce resource that nobody owns, or that we all own, and distribute it in a way that's worthwhile. Does that mean that in such a situation, some people will get less good care than they otherwise would purchase? The answer is perhaps. But precisely because they have no ownership right in the care that they're being given, that's exactly a necessary consequence. If we say there's a limited number of vaccines and we can't vaccinate everybody and all the vaccines are owned by the government, then it's the government's job to distribute the vaccines in a way that saves a large number of people. If there are a limited number of vaccines and I own six of them, then thank God I know the answer to this question. I have four children myself and a spouse. The six vaccines that I own go to me. The fact that you might be better served by these vaccines is nice but unimportant to me. I'm under no obligation to give you a vaccine and go on vaccinating, even if you're at a higher risk than I am. So within the United States right now, we are going through a vast conversation. The vast conversation is not about the details of rationing, as you see in many specific other conversations. We are instead going through a very broad conversation about who owns healthcare. Is the halakhic model, is the model of healthcare the model of individual ownership, in which I buy the goods that I need, they so to speak become mine, the fact that I allocate them in a way that's inefficient for society is unimportant? Or if we want a government-owned healthcare in which the government allocates healthcare decisions based on the best interests of society. I guess we'll take a few questions and then we'll talk for a few minutes about if the government owns healthcare, how does it in fact allocate?
Does the quote of NEFESH change healthcare from the status of all other people?
The answer goes as follows. If in fact I own a vaccine, and the risk to me of not being vaccinated is 20%, but the risk to you of not being vaccinated is 40%, I still am under no obligation to give my vaccine to you to minimize the risk to you, since it significantly increases the risk to me. So, of course, because that just plays a role. But once we recognize that the reason why the healthcare that I own, so to speak, I don't want to give to you is because my life, too, is in danger, so I'm not obligated to take a small risk to my life, even if by taking small risks to my life, I vastly increase the likelihood of you living. Meaning, as a matter of Jewish law, I need not undertake a 30% risk to my life, even to reduce a 90% risk to your life. Even though from an efficiency perspective, it would be very efficient for me to undertake a 30% risk to my life, to eliminate a 95% risk to your life, there is no Jewish law obligation to do that. So when I have an overabundance of health care, so that the risk to me of sharing with you is nearly zero, then it comes to play. But otherwise, it doesn't come into play.
When you say government owns, how do you factor in the fact that there are many who pay a Medicare tax and feel that it's their money that's going into this program, whereas there are people on Medicaid who never worked a day of their life, but then
Congress can change it or abolish it in any significant way. I don't think we would conceptualize Medicaid any differently than Medicare in the sense that the government provides it right.
But the fact that the government trains the adult physician means that the government can own those physicians?
I don't think so. But I think the government has created a healthcare system in which private healthcare is either very complex or very expensive or ultimately nothing to do with the law. Not necessarily by regulating physicians, but perhaps even by regulating physicians. I wouldn't find that to be contrary to the law.
In the example of the community building a well, are you punishing the other community because they're improving? You gave the example of building a district house. What if they built an orphanage? Or what if they couldn't afford building anything? I'm trying to understand if prudent improves is the issue, or if they don't live wonderful with their money, but still can afford to build a deep well, whether or not it would make a difference.
I don't think it makes any difference at all other than the sympathy, meaning if they built an orphanage, it would be prudent of them to come to us beforehand and say, let's make a deal. Which is, we'll take your orphans and you'll give us water. That would be a prudent deal. But I don't think it's directly related to the discotheque example at all, although the discotheque example simply highlights the fact that, that that's the case. So, again, go this way.
I'm also troubled by that water example that, that the community was short of drinking water. The other community wasn't required to give them water that could save their lives, but to wash their clothes or feed their, you know, isn't this to us benefit standing idly by while someone dies?
Yes, but I think the halakha answer goes as follows. Losing our cattle and losing our assets is also a form of communal pecuniary benefit that we don't have to give up. So I don't think we can water our nets, but I do think we can water our wheat. And that watering our wheat or preserving our communal assets is long-term people-up method to the community, which wouldn't normally trump any individual people-up method, but does in this kind of situation.
Are there any policy guidelines for the governing body in terms of deciding which resources can be public or private?
Yes, we're going to come to that when we finish. I mean, the last thing we're going to touch on is the dispute among the postmen about when the government is in charge, what rules should the government look to? That's not a small issue, but that's a less important issue than realizing that when the government is not in charge, these rules don't apply.
You mean which
tire example.
Okay.
Isn't time really a crucial factor here? In other words, if we analogize the spare tire to, say, plague or drought,
okay.
I have a spare tire, you don't, even if you were imprudent. And I say to you, I'll give you $100 for your tire, because I need the tire right now because I'm stuck on the highway. Meanwhile, 2 miles away, you can go to the gas station, use my $100 and buy a new spare tire. And we're both good, because I need the tire now. So if I have 6 vaccines, and I need the vaccine today, because I'm dying today, you're right, you have vaccines and I don't. But you can get another vaccine in a day from now, and you'll save my life and your own. In other words, isn't the immediacy of the situation to have some barrier, even if technically you're right that...
In the following sense, yes, if you can construct a case where you can reduce my risk to approximately zero, then yes. But the moment I say the drive to the new tire store is sufficiently great that I'm worried reasonably that I'll get a plaque before I can do this, then I can just say to you, no amount of money in the world can compel me to take this risk. In the handout, I gave you a couple of pages from a very famous article just published in Lancet. That's a very famous article. The lead author of the article is, anybody know? The lead author is the brother of the chief of staff of the President of the United States, a nice fine fellow, with an interesting Jewish last name. And he goes through resource allocation schemes within the structure of when the government is in charge. How does the government go about figuring out who should get resources and who shouldn't? And this, by the way, is clearly a dispute among the regional as well. When we have to allocate resources and the government is in charge, do we allocate resources in a utilitarian way, like Meteoria 1.0 seems to suggest? Do we allocate resources in a way that's grounded in the mere counting of individual lives? Do we look at instrumentality? There are any number of different schemes that are out there. I don't mean the word scheme in a negative sense of a lot of things, but just schematic diagrams for when the government is in charge and resource allocation has to take place. What kinds of resource allocations should we in fact take place? I sat on a committee at Emory University that examined the Grady triage rule. The first rule of triage, Grady, and gunshot rules is when multiple people come into the hospital being shot, which is a nightly occurrence. I kid you not, a nightly occurrence, the first person to get treated is the policeman. Doesn't matter if he's the sickest. It doesn't matter if he's the most urgently in need of care. When multiple people come in to be shot at Grady Hospital, multiple people have been shot. They don't come in to be shot. Then most people are shot, which is, by the way, also not nine times, but maybe two nights a week. There's a multiple shooting. The first person to be treated is based and determined on an instrumentality basis. If a police officer is shot, resources are allocated to the police officer against anybody else who comes to the hospital, and particularly against the people who come into the hospital who shot the police officer. Exactly because Grady and Emory have adopted an instrumentality view as its first line of triage, which is we save the people who save us. After that, we follow a more nuanced rule about dividing up resources, focusing on quality of life and length of life, the number of people we can save. But my point here goes as follows. When you deal with a government-controlled resource, at that point you're in a much more complex universe. There's an enormous literature in Halakha to start asking the following question. When the government has a shortage of resources and it can't give to everybody, who should it give to? I don't have time to review that piece of literature with you. And I didn't come here intending really to do that. There are three or four different views in the Rishonim. One is you just count numbers in line. One is you look at instrumentality. One of them is you even look at what we would call some sort of measure of quality, old versus young. Another is you look at long-term life potential. So we say the young over the old. There are different schemes is as we discuss rationing of health care, and this is the conversation that's running in the United States. When you listen to the conversation, do we want to have a government option? What we're really discussing here is we want to dramatically change the rules so that the ownership of health care now resides not in each and every one of us who purchases our right to health care through a health insurance policy, but instead shall be allocated to the government, who shall distribute it according to a schematic that's absolutely independent of private ownership. So this is an introduction to this issue. Many people in conversation, both as a matter of halakha and as a matter of even secular ethics, miss that the central divide is not how should the government divide resources. The central issue is whether you conceptualize health care as an individually owned right which you have purchased through a health insurance contract, in which case you own it and it's yours, or is the government provided right which comes to us from the government which allocates resources for the benefit of society as a whole. These two different constructs profoundly affect how halakha views resource allocation in the area of health care. It profoundly affects how halakha views resource allocation of spare tires in the automobile context. And it profoundly affects how halakha views the allocation of almost any scarce resource. Private assets need not be distributed in the public good. Public assets need to be distributed in the public good. We'll take one or two questions, and then I finish with my time, and then we'll go on to the next speaker.
According to your construct, you can never really change it, because the people who have private health care, if the government said they want to make it public system, people, the millions of people, just say
no. No, I don't think that that's right. I think the government can say, from the Sunday forward, there should be no more private contracts, giving reasonable notice and a reasonable construct. I think the government of Canada, as a matter of judicial office, generalized an area, make an area public rather than private, after providing due and reasonable notice. We point to many cases, even in Malacca, where that took place, where, for example, ownership of synagogues went in many situations from private to public and other areas. It's not a transition that's out of precedent in Malacca. Originally, communities had private walls. You and me built two houses together in walls on the woods in the Ukraine, and we started with a private wall put up by the two of us. And then more people added, we thought the wall was private. But then 50 years later, we discovered we were a little town with a neighbor, and there were 100 houses, and it was no longer a private wall, it was a public wall. If you haven't asked the question, people haven't asked the question, and priorities. Thank you very much.